So we're going to finish up the last bit of this packet here, but we're going to go through it fairly quickly. There'll be a couple sections I'll just point out to you. The last two pages, for example, are just yours to read. There's some shorthand for how to handle Old Testament narratives and the law. But let's continue on, press on. If we're going to talk about Exodus, I already kind of mentioned that Exodus is part of a larger section of texts that were addressing the question of who is God. So it's important to know how Exodus fits in this sequence of things. So we're going to really quickly run through Genesis through Deuteronomy, okay? Like in 5 minutes. Genesis, it's really helpful to think of Genesis as a prologue of sorts. Christians tend to put a lot of emphasis on Genesis because it talks about matters of creation. But it's helpful, actually, to think of Genesis as a prologue where the stage is being set. What's the setting? The setting is creation. Who are the characters? First and foremost, it's God, but it's also humanity, Israel in particular. A lot of the stage is being set for us there. They're talking about God and the world, Genesis 1 to 11, and then God and Abraham's family, Genesis 12 right through to 50. And if you're going to go big with this, think of God as being a God who creates order out of chaos and who partners with a family so that they can be agents of change in creation as well. And when you read the stories in Genesis, you'll realize that these people are pretty bad. They're not very good at what they do. But the whole point is, can they change? Being in a relationship with God, can they change? That makes sense to a lot of the double stories that happen and why Abraham's story looks a lot like Isaac's story, which looks a lot like Jacob's story, which looks kind of like Joseph's story. Because the question is, as Abraham's family grows, are they changing? Are they becoming the people God has called them to be? It's why you see why you see Abraham leaving Sarah twice, right? God makes this covenant. The nation's going to be blessed through you. You're going to have a huge family. Go for it. And the very first thing that Abraham does is pawn off his wife because she's too pretty. And there's no plan B. Like, he immediately sabotages God's plan, and God has to come and rescue Sarah. And then Abraham does it again. Why the two stories? Because the question is, has Abraham learned anything the second time around? Sarah does not treat Hagar well twice. The question is, has Sarah learned anything? Now, neither Abraham or Sarah come out smelling like roses out of even the second encounter, but the question is, are they growing? Are they changing? Is something happening here? Is order being created out of the chaos because of their relationship with God? Exodus, then, with the stage set, addresses the question, who does Israel belong to? God's promise is under threat. God promised that God's people would have a land, would look like him, etc. But who owns the people of God at the beginning of Exodus? Pharaoh. And it's really important that you don't think of Pharaoh like a person. Okay? Every movie ever treats Pharaoh like a person, and it misses the point. You'll notice if you read carefully that there's more than one Pharaoh in this story. There's a few, and they are never named because their names don't matter. What they are matters. And what Pharaoh is Ra's son incarnate. Pharaoh is a god. When you read Pharaoh, think small g god. And this god says, actually, Israel is mine. And now we're hitting the rising tension part. The promise is under threat. What will Israel do? What will God do? What is going to happen? That sets up Numbers. Leviticus. And it might seem strange to you to think of Leviticus as being a part of the climax of the Pentateuch, because for us, it's definitely not that part where everyone's dying from hail and boils and locusts. That's awesome. That's the climax. No. What's happening in Leviticus? Anybody? Yes. The last half of Exodus, the last full half of Exodus is focused on God's presence and God's gift of Torah, the gift of law that will help shape Israel to be the people he's called them to be so that they can worship the God of creation. This is big stuff. What do they lose in exile to Babylon? They lose God's presence, the temple, the tabernacle. They lose their vocation. They lose everything that this whole story is building towards. Leviticus is super dull for us, but it is an extremely big and important part of the story. Now, a lot of this comes to a head in Numbers. Numbers is alternating story and law. And again, it just feels like, oh, why do you put the law bits in when it's just getting exciting? What's happening, though, is we're finally seeing the people's character on display and God's justice and mercy at play as well. Because how do the people come off in Numbers, do you think? Not well. Not well at all. So much so, in fact, that God's justice kicks in and says, actually, you know what? You generation I just saved from Israel, from Egypt, you don't get to go to the land now. You are going to die in the desert, but your kids will. So the one generation dies, and the question hangs for the new generation, and Deuteronomy means second law. It's they've received it here, but they fall and fail miserably. But God's justice is on display, but God's mercy is on display as well. And he, and through a series of speeches from Moses, tells them, look, let's try this again. You have an opportunity. You're poised to enter the land. You have an opportunity to participate with God here. And Moses says in chapter 30 on, he says, you have two paths in front of you. One path leads to life and blessing. One path leads to death and destruction. Oh, that you would choose life. Choose life. And interestingly, I would say that we don't get a full resolution with the Pentateuch. It stops there. The question is, at the end of the Pentateuch, will Israel look like God? Spoiler alert. When is this being collected and gathered and written? In exile. They don't. So the question is, how did we get here? And who are we now? Because this whole story lays the groundwork for what it means to be a part of the people of God, both in Israel's day and in a very important way, but not as specific a way, for us as Christians today. The law doesn't hold a lot of relevance for us in terms of its specificities, but in terms of the role it plays in Scripture to show us God's character being worked out in a specific culture, absolutely. It reminds us that this stuff matters in a big way. So let's talk real quickly about narrative stuff, levels of narrative. Because the question is, how do I read this? Well, how do you read this? You pay attention to this kind of stuff, first of all. You'll see this in Exodus as well. I'll lay that out for you in a second. But one of the big things you're going to need to do is to learn to read contextually. When I say learn to read contextually, it means try and place things in their broader culture, their broader, in a bigger picture. memes online would not be funny. They're barely funny as it stands, but they would not be funny if you didn't have any kind of context for why Shrek is doing what he's doing or why whatever is happening. It doesn't make any sense if there's no larger context. It makes no sense. So we need to try and pay attention to context. So when you're reading Exodus and you feel like, boy, I feel like after reading Exodus, I feel like I'm allowed to go and get just hammered every weekend. I don't know how you would make that leap, but let's say you're creative and you make that leap in Exodus. And you feel like, boy, I feel like scripture has released me to substance abuse. Fantastic. I would say you are not reading contextually, because if you keep on reading, that's a bad thing. You don't want to do that. So you want to try and remember that Exodus is a part of a larger context, which is a part of the larger context of the Old Testament, which is part of the larger context of scripture as a whole. We could even include church tradition in there. And so there's lots of context to be paying attention to. So we're paying attention to those big picture things. Paying attention to, you know, next level, the collection. How does the Exodus fit in the Hebrew Bible, in Torah? How does the story itself play out? What about the cycles of stories that take place in Exodus? You'll realize that there's a lot of literary patterns going on in Exodus. We'll pay attention to those. The plague stories, for example, get smaller still. The individual stories, say each specific plague story that takes place in Exodus. And then literary structures. Some big literary structures to pay attention to, we'll just do this right in the middle here, is Semitic cultures love chiasms. A chiasm, really simply, would be this kind of pattern. Levi's a guy, a cool guy. So we've got guy, and that draws attention to the fact that this guy is cool. And that is about the weakest example of a chiasm I have ever done. But we'll draw attention to actual chiasms in Exodus. They love this stuff. And it's why when you're reading the Old Testament, I defy you to pick a book where this doesn't happen regularly. It feels like, good grief, they are repeating themselves over and over and over. You should ask why. Why would they be doing this? Here's an example of structure here. 25 to 31 is all about instructions on how to build the tabernacle. And it ends with Sabbath. Then we have this story of Israel's rebellion, the golden calf, which is immediately followed by a little reminder of Sabbath, and then the building of the temple using the exact same language as these chapters. The order is a little bit different. This order here reflects importance. This order here reflects pragmatics. But it's almost to the letter, the same language. You've got A, B, C, B, A. Where these things, this conversation about tabernacle is a conversation about presence. These conversations about presence bracket a look at Israel's rebellion in the face of God's presence. And the question that hangs in the balance here is, Israel has, just like Abraham did, Israel has immediately broken the covenant. It's still being written down and they've broken the covenant. So they've showed their character. What will God's character be like in the midst of this? And that's, narratively speaking, what makes sense of God sounding kind of, some people have said, the movie, what is it, Gods and Kings, the Exodus movie, make God out to be a little bit of a petulant child having a temper tantrum. And fair enough, kind of, because in this section here, God says, fine, forget you. I'll just stick with Moses. And Moses says, remember your promises. And God's like, meh. And Moses is like, please. And there's this conversation. It feels like, good grief, what's God doing? God's kind of the worst here. What they're trying to do is build tension and show that there is something cataclysmic on a knife's edge here. What is God going to do? Who is God? What is he like? And when God finally reveals himself, what he says is, I am a just God, and I punish people who don't follow me, but I forgive people to the thousandth generation. I am a God who is merciful. And even though you have broken this thing right out of the gates, I will bind myself to you still. Let's write those laws down again. Because, bracketed by Sabbath, Sabbath reminds us that God made the world. Creation. Presence, creation, this is God's world. There is an order to the world. And that order is anchored by God's character in the face of Israel's rebellion. And then we repeat that. This is actually the important bit. This is important in its own way, but it's all of this in conversation with each other that really drives the point home, that really matters. That's hard for us because that is a lot of reading to get that point. And you could be thinking, seriously, more lampstands? And you're struggling. But again, it's why it's helpful to know that big picture working its way down. By the way, lampstands, presents, etc. All of those elements in the tabernacle are meant to echo motifs of creation. You've got trees, these tree-like candelabras in the tabernacle, like the Garden of Eden, giving light in the darkness of an otherwise very dark Holy of Holies, creation. You've got the sea in a big brass bowl. It's a giant sink, is really what it is. But the idea is, again, water is chaos in the ancient world, and this water is contained and it's still. The temple, the tabernacle, is a microcosm of creation. And the God who lives there is a God who is gracious and merciful. And that matters because things are going to get really hairy up here. Okay? So Old Testament narratives are not, therefore, allegories with hidden meaning, like the story's getting in the way. No, it's not telling you the meaning of the story because it expects you to be in conversation with the community about how this story works itself out in your present situation. It is, you are breaking the thing if you're doing it strictly in private. You know, exclusively in private. You're doing it wrong. Talk about it, which is a very scary thing. I think especially for in a patriarchal culture, it's harder for men sometimes because men are supposed to be alpha males and know what they're doing and not look like an uneducated idiot. And when you start doing this, you cannot help but look like an uneducated idiot. Women use, this is a huge broad stroke, women use conversation as a way of signaling community. And so entering into conversations is a little bit easier. And it's why, look at any church, women's ministries are thriving and men are struggling to share their feelings and talk about this thing that they don't know about. So I'll just focus on hunting or video games or whatever. Okay. Stop that. Talk about it. So like I said before, they simply account for what God did or what Israel did. They're built around characters. Hebrew narrative is very scenic. So if you like binging Netflix, you will love the Bible. It's my pitch. So these scenes build. At least if you're watching a good TV show, okay? They build and they have consequence. So you can expect to find Genesis echoed everywhere in Exodus. You can expect to find Exodus echoed everywhere in Numbers. You can expect to find Deuteronomy and Exodus, two hugely important books, echoed throughout every text in the Old Testament and New. Every single one. Interestingly, you don't find the Genesis story ever covered in the same amount of detail that you find Exodus narratives told and retold and retold again, or Deuteronomy guiding how even Jesus talks about who God is and what God is on about. It just echoes all the way through its scripture. You can expect to find that as these scenes build on each other and draw on each other to communicate their meaning, okay? They often use dialogue to move the plot forward, which is why there's repetition, because they use patterns, etc. So while this is a story, I forget who mentioned that this is a story. It is a story, but it's not like any story you've read before. You have to recognize that they do things a little bit differently. Anybody know what Moses looks like? Nobody does. They never describe the guy. Ever. What does Abraham look like? How does Abraham feel about things? No clue. They don't tell us. They don't say, you know what? This is what Moses' interior space looks like. Doesn't happen. The very first guy in history really to start writing that way is Augustine, and that's like a long time later, okay? So they don't tell you how they feel about things. They just tell you that they're doing them. And you need to talk about why. And if you're not sure if your suggestion is right, then go to a wider context. Well, how does the rest of Scripture talk about this? How does this show itself in the prophets? How does it show itself in Jesus? How does this work itself out? Okay, you need to use the rest of the story to help you get a sense of what's going on here. And we talked about structures, etc. And the plot moves crazy fast. It moves crazy fast. And again, we just have to roll with it. So let's take a look at what this is all about. Now, what I've done here, mine is much longer and wordier. Whenever I read a book of the Bible, what I like to do is I try and break it up into its scenes, its acts, its larger sections. So it would be kind of like watching Breaking Bad all on one disc, and you have no idea when one season ends and begins. And they've taken the credits out, so you don't know when the episodes end or begin. You're doing the detective work to go, well, where do I feel like this narrative begins and finishes? And does that narrative belong to a part of a cycle of narratives that are telling a larger story, but not the whole story yet? And then expanding out from there. So that's what that little section there is doing. And a good example of that would be, I'll just start with the very, very beginning. I think a season, if you will, of Exodus is chapter 1 to chapter 6. And that is really about the rise of Moses. It sets the stage. It introduces us to what God is trying to do. He's trying to, we could say, rescue Israel. And he's going to send Moses to do that. Okay? Because Pharaoh is getting in the way. The next act would be the plagues, the liberation from Egypt. I call that 6:2 to 15:21. And that would be the plagues themselves. Now things get real. Going on from there. Now each of these I've also kind of broken down. So you've got the people of Israel increase, the people suffer in Egypt, but I broke the people suffering in Egypt down a little bit more. Now this is a really handy thing to do, and by the way, this isn't, quote, the right answer for how this is broken up. You can look at a few different books and they'll break them up slightly different ways for slightly different reasons, because you can imagine if you're watching Breaking Bad with no credits and it's all just blurred together and there's no seasons, it would be tricky to know when a season, when an episode ends and begins and providing a justification for why. That's tricky. But what you're doing when you do that is you're paying attention to larger contexts and you're trying to get some sense of the order of the story. Now, when I do this, I actually do this initially just in my Bible. Now here, that's a letter. I'll pick a gospel. So here. Here is the Gospel of Mark in my Bible. 1 second here. I'll start here. This is the Gospel of Mark in my Bible. I would love to say those are all devotional moments, but they're not. A lot of them are, why did Mark tell that story there? Wait a second, I'm noticing that there is not one, not two, not three, not there's four conflict stories happening, followed by four acts of mighty deeds on Jesus' part. There's some kind of parallelism happening there. I'm just identifying those things. I'm counting those things even. If you read the Gospel of Matthew, when Jesus goes on a mountain to give his people a new law, who does he look like? Moses. When's the last time you saw a guy on a mountain telling people how they should live? Moses. Then when Jesus goes down off the mountain, he performs a whole series of miracles that just feel kind of strung together. But if you count them, he performs 10 miracles. How many plagues are there? That's a softball. How many plagues are there? 10. Moses unmakes creation around Pharaoh. Jesus comes off his mountain and knits creation back together. Okay? It's the story told in a very Semitic way, using these structures and parallelisms, etc., hearkening back to earlier parts of the story to make their point. If you're like, yeah, but the whole Jesus-Moses plague thing, I'm not really sure I'm buying it. How does Matthew tell Jesus' birth narrative at the beginning of the gospel? Herod kills all the children in Bethlehem. When's the last time you saw somebody kill a bunch of children to stop what God is trying to do with Moses? Interestingly, the story behind Moses' birth has Moses' father and his mother, who is pregnant under mysterious circumstances, fleeing Egypt with Moses' dad leading his pregnant wife on, coming to Egypt, leading his pregnant wife on a donkey. When's the last time you saw a husband leading their pregnant wife on a donkey towards Egypt?
Jesus.
Matthew tells his whole gospel in a way that screams, when you think of Jesus, think of Moses, but better than Moses, more than Moses. Matthew's gospel has the beatitudes, the blessings. This is what this is how you're blessed if you follow me. Unfortunately, Israel says, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. And so Jesus, at the end of Matthew, pronounces curses on them. Where do you see somebody pronouncing blessings and curses on people who have a decision in front of them? Deuteronomy. Moses does that. And in fact, in Deuteronomy, Moses says, one day there will be a prophet greater than me who's going to come. Listen to him. And then it says, but to this day, that prophet hasn't arrived. And so Matthew goes, ah, there's a thing I can tie into. And he tells his story about Jesus in a way that says, the prophet has finally arrived, and he is so much better than Moses. Okay? A perfect example of scenes building off of other scenes, stories being echoed and repeated, but we're not told that it's happening. We're just expected to know the story. So this helps you see the story. It slows your reading down, and it makes you ask questions. And often, because we don't know what we're talking about, those questions tend to be the right questions. It's like a little kid asking why for everything. That's a good question. It's just really annoying. But it's the right question, because we don't know how to ask the wrong questions yet. We haven't learned that asking the wrong questions is the wrong thing to do. So if narratives are built like this, we can expect that Exodus 1 to 6 is going to be really important for setting the stage as far as the rest of the narrative goes. Okay, and it's true, we find that. When you're reading through Exodus 1 through 6, what you see is the story of Moses. It's a continuation of the story of Genesis. The people of God are flourishing. In fact, it uses the same language as Genesis 1. They are being fruitful and multiplying. Are they doing this in the land, though? They're doing this in the wrong land. They're doing this in Egypt. And Pharaoh comes along and tries not just to stop a growing people, but tries to get in the way of God's creation purposes. He says, there's too many of you, and so we're going to cull the herd. we're going to start killing you off. And that's what he does. So the threat here is, you have to see Pharaoh as this anti-creation force, this guy who is at work not against Israel, but against God. Because the conflict that's going to play out in the plagues is not Moses versus Pharaoh. It's not Israel versus Egypt. It's Pharaoh, who is a god, versus this mysterious god whose name he does not know. And when that mysterious god comes along, does he say, I'm here to free Israel because I feel bad for them? No. He says, these people need to come out of your land into my land, make the way to my land, so that they can worship me, because they are mine, and you will know my name. Before this is over, everyone will know my name. Because the very first thing Pharaoh says when Moses comes along and says, I'm from Yahweh, let my people go, Pharaoh says, who's Yahweh? Never heard of the guy. And God says, you will. Everyone will. So one of the things that happens when we're talking about Pharaoh, people tend to get really squeamish when we read that God is hardening Pharaoh's heart. And they go, oh my goodness, what about free will? Because we're modern Westerners and we love abstract questions. Free will is a big problem. They don't really care. They're not addressing the question of free will. They're addressing the question of, is God going to let Pharaoh tap out when he's just gotten started? No, because you don't know my name yet. And everyone will know my name because you are the king of the hill right now. Nobody tops Egypt. Let me introduce myself. Okay? And that's how it starts. It's really great when you have that in mind, because it makes reading through repetition and some of the minutiae a little bit easier when you know this is what's happening, this is what's being set up. Now also, when Moses is being introduced and his story is being introduced, being set up, it's not just Moses' story, it's Israel's story. Israel's story in the past and Israel's story in the future, because Moses is kind of Abraham-ish in the fact that he's going to be the vehicle that God uses to bring his people into the place they're supposed to be. Okay. Not only that, but when Moses is put into a basket and put out in the water, the word that they use for basket is the same word. It's only used twice in scripture. It's used once here, and it's used once when Noah enters the ark. The ark is the same word used for the basket. So Moses is put in an ark and put out on the amongst the reeds in the water, which again foreshadows the Red Sea, which is also called the Reed Sea. So we're getting all these echoes. They don't mean anything other than that these stories are all part of the same story. Noah's story is happening again. Moses' story is actually the story of the people themselves. When Moses goes to try and free an Israelite and he socks that one Egyptian and kills the guy, and was Israel free at that moment? What does Moses do after he kills the guy? He runs. He bolts. Because Moses without God, Israel without God, can do nothing. You can hit a guy in the face really hard, but that's really all you can do. There needs something else. There needs to be something else added to the mixture here, and that's God. And that point is driven home when God tells Moses, go and face off against Pharaoh, and you got this, and here we go. And so Moses does go in chapter 5 to face off against Pharaoh, and the thing falls flat on its face. And actually, Pharaoh makes Israel do more work. And Israel, foreshadowing their behavior in the future, says, good grief, I wish you'd never even come here. But we're being reminded, Moses can do nothing apart from God. So God says, let's do this again, and I will show up this time. It's not that God's a jerk and didn't show up the first time. It's that the writers are trying to make the point, Moses can do nothing on his own. If they're going to be free from Egypt, only God can accomplish that. Okay. Again, it's using these scenes and using actions and dialogue to make a point. Sometimes the point is negative, and we feel like, why is God being a bully and not helping the first time? because it would lose the narrative impact of God coming and helping the second time in a really big way. So we don't confuse Moses with God, because God is the one who saved us, not Moses, as good as the guy is. Also, there's kind of, I mean, this is small potato stuff, but it is kind of fun. Moses is under threat a number of points in chapters 1 through 6. And you know who saves his butt every time? Women. Women help him. Worth noting, it's kind of similar to the gospel narratives, that the key players in many respects are women. It's a young woman, Mary. It's the women who arrive at the tomb and are charged to go and tell the disciples. Luke structures his whole gospel in a way that highlights the role of women and people on the margins. The same thing happens here. Pharaoh has this lovely plan to kill all the kids. And who outsmarts Pharaoh? The midwives. Pharaoh doesn't get named. The midwives do. They get names. That tells you the level of respect they have for Pharaoh and the respect they have for these women who are successful because they are following God's will. And so even people who follow God's will can trump a Pharaoh. That's an important point to recognize. The plagues themselves are very interesting. This is chapters 7 to 15 now. I don't want to talk about everything. So I actually have my little notes in here. I deleted all of my notes and just gave you headings that may or may not be helpful. They're only helpful if you read Exodus. So guess what you have to do. But what I would do if I were you is either you can agree with my headings and my separations or not, but try and describe what's happening in there. And some of my descriptions are really not very intelligent. There's one bit where God is telling them how to build an altar. He doesn't want them to make anything grand. He says, use the stones that I provided you. This is my creation. Don't build it in a way that shows off your nudity, because they aren't wearing underwear. My notes on that bit were... Hold on. Nothing fancy, just use rocks. Oh, and I don't want to see your bits. That's what I wrote down for 22 to 26. Nothing fancy, just like you, and I don't want to see your bits, with a slant face, smiley face on there. So you're not trying to impress anybody. You're just trying to go, what is going on here? How do I summarize this? But one of the things you'll notice when you read through you might notice this, is that there's rhythms even to the plagues. So for example, who here has seen Prince of Egypt? Really? Okay, you should watch Prince of Egypt. It's a wonderful movie. It's very well done. But there's a scene that's not helpful in the Prince of Egypt, where the magicians are facing off against Moses and Aaron. You know, they drop their staff into a serpent, and the priest sneaks some serpents into the mix. They turn the Nile to blood, and they do some sneaky trickery and do the same thing. That's not what's happening here. What is happening here is Moses does something, and they do the exact same thing because they can, too. Okay? That might frustrate us, because we feel like, no, there's no such thing as magic or other gods, and so they can't do this, and so end of story. They don't care about what you think in 2018. They're telling you that when Pharaoh faces off against Moses on his turf at his power base, the Nile, he can do what Moses can do too. The question that we should be asking is, Moses just turned the Nile to blood. Why wouldn't you turn it back to water? Moses is unraveling creation around you, and all you can do is the same thing? That's not super awesome. You should be wanting to fix this. And as soon as the plagues step away from the Nile, the very first time that happens, the magicians can't do it anymore. And they say in that moment, we're in trouble. this is the finger of God at work. And a few plagues later, this is the hand of God at work. Like it's increasing in severity. More of God is showing up in this thing. The point is, you think you're strong. And yeah, you've got some strength. But let me show you who I am. Because I made all of this. And you think you can stop my creation purposes, the flourishing and multiplying of my people? You can keep them in your land? No, if you think you're so powerful, then fix this. Frogs everywhere. Fix this. Hail, destroying all your crops. Or let's get really epic. Total darkness except for where Israel is. And boy, does that look like winding the clock back on the creation story. The separation of light and dark, and God says, turning it off. And who is Ra the god of?
Sun.
The sun. And God turns it off. And Pharaoh has long since tapped out. He's long since tapped out. And God says, no, because you will know my name. You will know who brought my people out of this place. You will know who is in charge, and it is not you. And when he's leading his people along, and Pharaoh kind of snaps up and goes, well, that was stupid. Let's go and kill them, and runs after them. God does this very biblical thing where he separates these chaotic waters, right? And dry ground, this creation thing happens, and Israel walks through, and God says effectively to Pharaoh, you think you're a God who can create order out of chaos? Here's some water. Fix it. And everyone dies. Everyone dies. Not a person survives. That's something. And again, who is reading this? Israel in exile to the biggest, baddest power of the day. And they're wondering, who is God? And who are we? God says, well, you're the kind of people that get yourselves in exile. That's who you are. I'm the kind of guy that doesn't forget his people in exile. And if you think these people are big and bad and powerful and strong, let me promise you they are not. Because I am the God of creation. And I will do this again. That's Isaiah's promise. This will happen again. There will be water poured out in the desert. There'll be new creation. The law that Moses gave will be written on our hearts. So when they come out of exile, there's this little like prelude kind of thing or interlude where they're going from Egypt to Sinai. And there's lots of echoes back and lots of looking forward, just treated as that. It's kind of this lull in the story, but it's like the second book in a trilogy for those of you who read fantasy or science fiction. It's important, but you want to get to the third book. The third book in this trilogy is God finally, chapter 19, saying, I have picked you. I have chosen you. You are my son. Do you accept me as your father? I have chosen you. Will you choose me? And they say wisely, yes, yes, please. And then God says, because this is the thing, they've been freed, but what's the point of this story? Is the point of this story freedom? The point of this story is not simply freedom. This is only this part of the narrative right now. The point is, you need to look like me. And let's be straight, in that interlude there, all you did was whine and complain and say, oh, I wish I could go back to Egypt. So if you are going to fulfill your role in looking like me, if you want to be my children, you need to behave a certain way in my house. Here are the house rules. And this is not onerous for Israel. Israel's not like, oh, really? Shoot. When you read the Old Testament, they are thrilled to have the gift, the gracious gift of God's law. They're thinking, finally, we know how to be in the world. Even in the New Testament, it's a little bit murky sometimes because they're critical of certain representations of it. But what does Jesus say he's coming to do? To totally abolish the law and change every jot and tittle in the thing? He's very clear, I am not here to do that. That's the last thing I want to do. And do we ever hear at any point that Jewish Christians are instructed to stop being Jewish? No. The big question is, do Gentiles need to look Jewish? And Paul says no, but this is Paul saying no to Gentiles, while Paul himself, while Jewish Christians themselves, still went to temple, still celebrated the festivals, still did all of that stuff, because that's who they are. That's who they were. There is a straightforward continuation of the story going on here. It's a little bit nuanced, but it's pretty straightforward, because the fact of the matter is, Paul says, now that Jesus has come, if you follow Jesus, you fulfill the law. So they don't need the law anymore. But at this stage in the game, we are not in the Gospels. This stage, we are in the people are sacrificing their children to Moloch, and maybe let's have some house rules. Don't kill your kids like that. Okay? Maybe. And we get some of those, and they love God for that. They love God for that. And God says, on top of the house rules, on top of a way to shape you to be the people you aren't yet, but I am calling you to be, I am going to live with you. I'm going to dwell with you. And so we get that in the tabernacle, this account of how God is going to live with them. And again, the tabernacle is creation writ small. Just like Israel is a symbol for all of humanity writ small. There's little details that are kind of fun if you know that temples and tabernacles function this way. You know the temple curtain tears in the Gospels? On the temple curtain was a map of the cosmos as far as they understood it. So think of the curtain as being like a giant picture from the Hubble telescope on display. This is the universe. And the universe tears open and God pours in. That's the symbol kind of at play there. The universe made small. The creation made small. It's why the priests are wearing vests with pomegranates hanging from their tassels, because they're supposed to be fruitful trees looking like God. You'd be like, that's dumb. But that's because we don't do that these days. Especially if you go to a low Protestant church. Pastors look like me, but with hip tattoos. So that's what's going on there. And it's why the presence thing matters as well, because of what's going on in the rebellion there. But we've already talked about the rebellion. But as you're reading this, the big question that's going to come up is, but what do I do with the law? What do I do with the fact that when I read the law, Levi said this is God's character on display, but hokey smokes, women got a rough deal. I think God's a pig. I don't really want to go this route. Again, this is where it's really important to recognize this is God's word written in human words, and this is God's character being worked out in an ancient Near Eastern culture. It's why when they move to the land, when they tell the story of the conquest of the Promised Land, it's told like a vicious, bloodthirsty affair, when the archaeological record tells us it wasn't. So why do they write it that way? Because that's how people talked in those days. And they weren't, at the end of the day, fights between, yours is the only name I know, Levi and Kaylee. Okay. The fight is between Kaylee's God and Levi's God. Kaylee's entire way of being in the world versus Levi's entire way of being in the world. And we want to be very clear that only one of those ways wins. And so you hear when Joshua goes in, every living thing is decimated. Everyone died. They killed the kids. They killed the women. They killed the sheep. Everyone died. And then immediately following, and then they took the survivors and you think, well, what's going on here? Well, that's what's going on. They're saying God's way won. There is no abstraction of God from his people or God from his creation. So they don't tell the story in that way. They tell the story in a very visceral, dirty, blood under your fingernails kind of way. That makes us feel a bit awkward. But that's what's going on. When you're reading the law, do not feel guilty if you are wearing clothing of mixed fabric. That's okay. All right. But interestingly enough, the laws don't start specific, they start broad. They start 10 commandments. And the 10 commandments are not comprehensive. Okay, you could think of all sorts of nasty crimes you could commit, you know, that are outside of the 10 commandments. So they're not there to be emblematic of everything, but they're there to show, I don't like the word principles, but I'll use it here. These are larger principles of God's character that in the next four chapters, you're going to see worked out in a specific cultural context. So God doesn't want you to lie. So here's how that works out if you own slaves, if you own your daughter, if you, you know, go through like this. Interestingly, if you read Israel's law code versus other law codes of the day, because there are lots of law codes of the day, the interesting thing is a lot of these law codes are missing two very important words that Israel's law code has sprinkled everywhere. And those words are always and never. Always and never. You will always do this. And you will never do this. Other law codes exist to keep the person at the top at the top. They exist to keep Pharaoh in his seat and everyone below him. They exist to keep the Babylonian king in his seat and everyone below him. But who's king as far as Israel is concerned? God. And because God is, and because people are made in God's image, you will never own anybody. And you will have these jubilee years where people will work for you and then you will release them. And you will always take the stranger in because you were strangers too. And you don't get to try and maintain your status quo. You live to maintain God's status quo. And God's character does not change. And so you will always do this and you will never do that. And what happens when they break those laws? The covenant says, stone them, kill them. You think, well, again, I'm not comfortable with that. The point is, there is a way to be in the world, and there are consequences for not being that way. I've got three girls, so we were already having wonderful sex talks with our three girls, because we need to. And what the latest stat is that by the time people are 24, I think they say it's something like 85 or 86% of the population is or has been sexually active. So again, if that's the current script people are reading off of, I will be having this conversation with my daughters at age 3, 5, 6, and 9, because I want to have a different script. Because for women, far more than for men, there are consequences for living in the world a certain way. And I would rather their lives weren't made harder than they're already going to be. And that is essentially what the law is saying. It's saying, you know what? You can go and do that. But I promise, if you turn into a saber-rattling people, and if you forget the fact that you're a rest-stop nation on the way to the real big dogs, they will own you in a second. So don't do it. If you lie to people, they will not trust you. So don't do it. Proverbs lays all these things out very, very clearly. There are consequences for this. So live according to God's precepts. And then when the question arises, but what if I'm living that way and they come and kill me anyways? I mean, that's what's happening in exile. There's stories from exile that are heartbreaking. Stories of, this is in a section of the Bible called the Apocrypha. A lot of our Bibles don't have it. Protestant Bibles don't have it. But if you've got a Catholic Bible or a NRSV, some NRSVs have it in there as well. The Apocrypha tells stories of a woman who has her children paraded out in front of her and they say, deny God or we'll kill your kids. And she looks at her kids and she tells her kids to be brave because she can't. And so one by one, they burn her children to death in front of her. This is what Israel's facing. This is why there's that Psalm, Psalm 137. It's a real nasty piece of work where Israel says to Babylon, I look forward to the day someone takes your kids and smashes their heads against the rocks. Because that's what's happening to us. That's what you're doing to me. There's no, but I'm sorry. You know, praise God. It's just that I hope someone kills your kids like you killed mine. This is what they're dealing with. And it is tremendously important to these people that they know that even if I'm responsible for getting myself in this mess, God will honor his end of the covenant nevertheless. God will come and say, you know what? Yes, I'm a just God. I punish people to the third and fourth generation, but I am a merciful God first. and I forgive people to the thousandth generation. It's really important to know that. And it's why that woman in that moment can say, be brave to her kids, because she knows that. And in that time, this theology is developing. God promised me blessing if I looked like him. That's what all of this is saying. It's this picture of blessing. God has promised me this, and I am dying here. Maybe in your study groups, you feel like, yeah, I hear this, but I've got depression. Maybe like me, you were abused as a kid by someone. Whatever the case may be, you're suffering some kind of mental illness, something like that. And you feel like, I'm not feeling blessed right now. Creation doesn't feel super hot for me right now. You need to know that God is a God who is merciful in the end. And you need to know the gospel part of the story, which is that even if your enemies should crush you, even if you've got a bipolar diagnosis and that thing's never going away, you feel like, well, what do I do then? There is restoration. There is new creation, and your life will be given back to you. That's the whole resurrection hope. It's not some airy-fairy body in heaven. It's your life given back to you. Heaven come to earth. And that theology is born out of people wrestling with this theology in the face of extreme suffering. And what they say is not, well, forget this, hang this, there is no God. What they say is, maybe the blessing I'll receive isn't in this life, but in a life to come. And I trust God so much, given his action in past events, that I will tell my children as they face their deaths to be brave, because I trust that God will look after them. That's something. Imagine the faith that a woman like that has to have, where she doesn't have this lovely resurrection theology. She has stories of how God has acted in the past. She's got stories of God's character. She's got a clear-eyed recognition of her own sin, but she knows who God is. And so she's willing to bet the house, bet the bank on God doing what he did in the past. God will rescue us even from death. And all of that comes from this, from the Pentateuch. It doesn't come solely from Jesus. If you're wondering why the New Testament is all about resurrection, it's because the hell that Israel goes through in between the Testaments is so severe, they're looking for some kind of meaning beyond this. And there's this resurrection hope that gives birth. But what do you have to do to have that resurrection hope? The Gospels say, pretty simple. It's the same thing that took place in Exodus when God came down and said, here, look like me. Jesus comes down and says, here's the deal, follow me. It's the same deal I gave your ancestors. Things got messy there, things got muddy there, and they're paying those consequences, but it's time to right that wrong. It's time to bring mercy and forgiveness to bear here. All of that theology comes from here. So when you're reading Exodus, don't think of this as some dry, dusty thing, even when it's a bit dry and dusty. It's not that. We just don't quite know how to read it yet, and we don't have this big picture firmly in our back pocket. So as you're reading through, try and get a sense of what each paragraph is doing. Ask, why is it happening where it's happening? What is it doing? Where is it going? If you've got the ear or the eye for it, see if you can hear echoes of Genesis. If you know the rest of the story, see if you can anticipate foreshadowing that's happening. If you know the Jesus story, pay attention to how that picks up on these things here, and you'll start to see how all of this thing... who read this? Who read the Silmarillion again? It works. The creation story that takes place in the Silmarillion. The Silmarillion is the Old Testament to the Lord of the Rings, for those of you who have no idea of what we are talking about. But the creation story that happens because Ilúvatar, the god, the one god behind everything in Lord of the Rings, has his children, lesser gods, and he gives them all a part and they start to sing. And as they sing their own parts, they realize that they're forming this beautiful, beautiful choir, and everything has a place, and there's a place for everything, and it's gorgeous. This is a part of a larger choral performance of Scripture. So if you have the ear for it, try and hear those melodies and harmonies that are coming down the pipe. Try and hear those ones that were introduced right here and make note of them. Just make note of them because it will enrich your reading of Exodus. Now, after lunch, we are going to talk about some pragmatics. We're going to talk about how we talk about this. How do I actually sit down and prep this, because we're meeting on Tuesday and I'm busy and what do I do? How do I talk in public about this, because I don't do that and I'm a frightened squirrel? We'll talk about that.